From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with medical anthropologist Andrea Sankar about why more Americans are taking their loved ones out of the hospital to spend their final days at home. Sankar is the author of a guidebook called Dying at Home. She wrote it after caring for her own dying mother at home. Also, the darkening mood in Czechoslovakia. Journalist Lawrence Weschler tells us about the differences between Czechs and Slovaks, which might lead to the dissolution of Czechoslovakia. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews intellectual memoirs by Mary McCarthy about her years in New York from 1936 to 38. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin arrived in Washington this afternoon and was welcomed by President Bush, not as an adversary, but as a friend. Yeltsin is seeking U.S. endorsement of a $24 billion Western aid package for Russia. The two leaders will discuss an agreement that's designed to make reductions in the U.S. and Russian nuclear arsenals that go beyond the latest START treaty. Yeltsin will also address a joint session of Congress on Wednesday, a first for any Russian or Soviet president. The Supreme Court ruled today that the U.S. government may kidnap people from a foreign country and prosecute them. By a 6-3 vote, the justices said an extradition treaty between the United States and Mexico did not prohibit the abduction and arrest of a Mexican doctor accused of killing a U.S. drug agent. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Alvarez Machain, a medical doctor, is accused of participating in the murder by prolonging Agent Camarena's life so that others could torture and interrogate him. But Machain was beyond the easy reach of the U.S. law in Mexico, and so the DEA paid a number of people in Mexico to kidnap the doctor and deliver him across the border to U.S. agents. Once here, Alvarez Machain was charged with Agent Camarena's murder. But the Mexican government protested that the U.S. had acted illegally in kidnapping the doctor and had violated the terms of the U.S.-Mexican extradition treaty. Two federal courts agreed and dismissed the case, but today the U.S. Supreme Court reinstated the prosecution, ruling that the abduction by the U.S. government or its paid contractors does not prevent a criminal prosecution in this country. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
The foreign minister of Bosnia-Herzegovina today appealed to the United Nations Security Council to authorize military force against Serbia. He also said NATO forces should be used to carry out the attacks. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Foreign Minister Haris Salajic said airstrikes are needed to stop the relentless artillery attacks on Bosnia by Serbian forces and to reopen Sarajevo airport for the delivery of humanitarian aid. He said only NATO has the air power necessary to neutralize Serbian weapons. At a press conference, Salajic called on the UN to authorize an assault.
I think we are at a stage where a coordinated military action is imperative.
Salajic did say he was pleased by the signs of opposition to the war among Serbian student and church groups. Meanwhile, President Bush said today that the U.S. would take a wait-and-see attitude toward Bosnia's appeals for help. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained less than a point to close at 3,354.9. Declines led advances by a margin of about 9-7 in moderate trading of 159 million shares. This is NPR News. More than 1,000 people were arrested overnight in Chicago after a celebration of the Chicago Bulls National Basketball Association victory degenerated into violence and looting. The celebration surged into the streets after the Bulls beat the Portland Trailblazers to win their second NBA title in a row. Two police officers were shot, but not seriously wounded. A report released today by the House Interior Committee indicates that the Forest Service has grossly exaggerated reforestation and growth rates of forests in the Northwest, allowing larger timber cuts than can be sustained. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The study covers 15 national forests in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and California. House Interior Committee Chairman George Miller, who last year was a leading voice against timber mismanagement in Alaska's Tongass National Forest, says that in spite of repeated assurances by the Forest Service, the forests that are being cut down are not growing back. The study details these so-called phantom forests, logged areas which have not regrown but are officially classified as reforested. According to the report, by exaggerating inventories and areas of reforestation, the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management are justifying the harvest of more timber than can be sustained under federal environmental laws. The Forest Service and the BLM have not commented on the study's findings. Miller's committee will vote Wednesday on a proposal to ban logging across 8 million acres of old-growth forests in the Pacific Northwest. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
President Bush said today that the release of the remaining Western hostages in Lebanon could lead to better relations with Iran. In an interview today with Cable News Network, the president reacted to news that two German aid workers have been released after more than 2 years in captivity. If the reports are true, the president said they serve as further vindication of a policy of not negotiating with hostage takers. The hostage takers are believed to have been influenced by the fundamentalist government of Iran. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There was a time when the elderly and the terminally ill died at home. Over the past 50 years, advanced medical technology has offered the possibility that death could be delayed or prevented by hospitalization. But recently, there's been a movement toward bringing dying loved ones back home so their remaining time can be spent outside the institutional atmosphere of the hospital or nursing home. Advances in home-based medical technology and changes in insurance reimbursement have contributed to this trend. No matter how committed you are to caring for someone at home, the responsibility can be overwhelming and frightening. My guest, Andrea Sankar, is a medical anthropologist and author of the new book, Dying at Home, A Family Guide for Caregiving. It's based on interviews she conducted with men and women who took care of loved ones dying at home. In a little while, Sankar will tell us about her own experiences taking care of her dying mother. Sankar says part of what is involved in the decision to care for a dying person at home is the desire to allow that person to live out life in as normal a way as possible, to have the experience of living while dying.
Well, I think when people are dying at home, it gives them some sense of control over what's left of their lives. It also gives them the sense that they're still alive. I mean, when they're in the hospital, they're a patient. And when they're a patient, that means that they give up some aspects of, you know, who they are, like their ability to say no when somebody comes into the room, or their ability to wear their own clothes or eat the food they want. And they do that with the idea that they're going to get better. That's sort of a bargain they make with the hospital. But when they're at home, they don't have to give up any of those sort of aspects of personhood, because they are in their own home and they're in control again, and they're able to live out the rest of their life as much as possible.
Did you find that a lot of the people who you spoke with who had family members die at home, did you find that they had certain fears of having someone die in the house?
People who hadn't had someone die in the home were often quite frightened by it. People were often very influenced by things they'd seen on TV. I mean, they imagined that there was going to be some ghostly light appear or a cold wind or sometimes very irrational fears. Or they thought the death would be quite gruesome. I mean, they thought of images of Hollywood, and they were extremely frightened by that. And one of the things that a hospice, you know, a trained hospice person can do is to be there with you when the dying is taking place. There's nothing, you know, that it is not a supernatural occurrence. A death is something that's within the normal range of behavior. I mean, you may not have seen a death before, but there's nothing that's going to happen that is somehow totally different from what one would expect. But not knowing what to expect or not knowing what can happen, it can be very frightening. And so one of the things I did in my book, one whole chapter, is it consists of death narratives with the caregiver describing exactly what happened when somebody died, so that people can see that, you know, it can be very, you know, it is not that frightening. It is, however, and this is significant, it's not always the case that people slip into a coma and die in their sleep. In fact, that only happened in one case. You know, it tends to be the case that when you leave a hospital with somebody and you ask the physician, use the caregivers, ask the physician, what will happen when so-and-so dies? Physicians tend to say, oh, they'll slip into a coma and die quietly. That very rarely happens. You know, people are very often awake when they die, and they can be frightened and you can be frightened, and there are things you can do to reassure them, you know, and make that death much more peaceful. But it's not the case that they just sort of die in their sleep.
In your book, you write that we used to know how to sit with the dying, and we're forgetting how to do that. Explain what you mean, since we still do sit with the dying, although it's often in the hospital during visiting hours as opposed to at home.
Well, what I mean by that is we don't really know how to take care of the dying. You know, we don't know what needs to be done with them. We don't know how to be the main source of comfort for them. In the hospital, you can sit there and hold their hand and talk with them, but you often are the one, you know, you often let the nurse do most of the, you know, comforting and straightening and attending. A great deal of caring for somebody who's imminently dying, say, you know, within 2 to 3 weeks of death, is simply comfort measures. It's helping them to eat what they can eat, what little they can eat. It's helping them to keep their mouth moist. It's helping them to, you know, keep their bodies clean. A lot of that is very basic nursing care. It's sitting with them when they can't sleep at night because they're frightened. It's maybe giving them a massage. It's things like that that people, because they've given over that sort of, you know, folk knowledge to hospitals, they don't know how to do it anymore. And those are the things people need to relearn.
Well, you know, that reminds me, when we're talking about bringing a dying person home, what are we talking about in terms of the amount of time that they have left to live and how much time you would be called on to be a full-time caregiver? And in your experience and in the experiences of the people who you interviewed, how much time did the dying person have left?
Well, you know, I should say that there are dying people who don't go into a hospital before, you know, they're not all discharged from the hospital home to die. There are people who, you know, have stayed at home most of their terminal illness. But the intense time period I'm thinking about, the period that I call active dying, is, I would say, really about 2 months. Up before that time, people can be very sick, but they often are somewhat ambulatory. I mean, they can walk, they can take care of themselves to some extent, so they don't need your intensive care. I would say 2 months is really at the outside. It's more likely 6 weeks to a month where you can be doing intensive round-the-clock nursing care. And the thing people have to remember is that when a dying person is in the hospital, they may be in an intensive care unit. They're definitely on a hospital floor where they're able to get 24-hour nursing care. When they come home, you're the person who's giving them that 24-hour nursing care. Their needs don't change. You know, one of the striking things about this experience, and it sounds a little ironic, is that the dying person is very, very sick. I mean, sicker than you can ever imagine unless you've been in that situation. And they require a tremendous amount of care.
So it really is quite a sacrifice for someone to care for a loved one at home who is dying.
It is, but I want to say two things about that. One, almost all the people, except for one person who did it, said it was probably the most important thing they'd ever done in their life. So it is a sacrifice, but it is it's extremely rewarding. The other thing I want to say is unfortunately, given the way health policy is moving, which is to have less and less care in the hospital, or to have shorter and shorter hospital stays, combined with, you know, dramatic advances in medical technology and pharmacology, so that more and more care can be given in the home, it's entirely possible that within the next 10 to 15 years, it won't be really, unless you have an acute problem, it won't be possible to die in the hospital. That whether, you know, the caregivers like it or not, the choice will be either dying at home or dying in a nursing home.
If you're just joining us, my guest is medical anthropologist Andrea Sankar. She's the author of the new book, Dying at Home, A Family Guide for Caregiving. When you're caring for someone and that person has died, then what happens? Who do you call? Who do you call to take away the body?
One, you don't want to call 911, because if you've prepared for a home death, when you call 911, all they will do is come and try to revive the body. So many hospices suggest that you wait until the body is actually cold. Now, some people want to have the body removed right away and feel that they have to have the body removed right away and will call a funeral home and have them come out. I found in my study that if people who allowed the body to stay in the home, say 6 to 8 hours, had a much easier time saying goodbye to the person and resolving their conflicts. They treated that time, they were able to go in, be with the person, spend some time, maybe some friends came over, people who've been involved in the caregiving were able to come over and take a very intimate, personal goodbye with a person. And also, if children had been involved, children could view the body in the sort of the privacy of their home. That period, allowing that period of time, seemed to make a great deal of difference to people rather than having the body taken away immediately. after a certain point of time, they were ready for the body to leave. It wasn't like they wanted to have the body there all the time, but at a certain point they said, okay, now it's okay for the body to go. But they did want the body to remain there for a while, and they felt much better about it. One of the benefits of having a home death is that you can make an arrangement with a funeral director before the person dies. So the funeral director is expecting you to call. And in many cases, now this varies by state, but in many cases, a physician can sign the death certificate before someone dies, and you just fill in the date so that you don't even have to have a physician come out. If the hospice nurse is there, of course, the hospice nurse can help you with all of this, but you may not have to have the physician come. You may be able to keep this just a completely private family affair. And when you feel that you have resolved, you're ready to say goodbye to the person completely, then you can call the funeral home. There's no need to rush it.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest, Andrea Sankar, is a medical anthropologist and author of the new book, Dying at Home, A Family Guide for Caregiving. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Andrea Sankar is my guest. And I was interested to find that in your study of families who cared for a loved one at home, that you had a very broad definition of family. You're just not talking about blood family, nuclear family.
Absolutely. And that's an important point. I'm glad you brought it up. By family, I mean any group of people that come together and think of themselves in a very responsible, caring relationship. And this is particularly important when we're talking about HIV-positive people. Because the AIDS, people who have AIDS, those people often are estranged from their family of birth, and the people who care for them become family to them. Those are their informal caregivers, their colleagues, their lovers, their companions. And I my book is about those people too. I mean, it's about any kind of people who provide that intensive, extremely committed care to a dying person.
Now, you cared for your mother when she was dying. This was in 1987. How did you make the decision to do that?
We really didn't consider anything else. I mean, I'd worked in home care for so many years. I knew sort of what the issues would be involved, and I knew the kinds of things we could expect. And when it became clear that the hospital couldn't help her anymore, we just felt seriously that she should be at home with us. And I didn't know how difficult it was going to be, but we didn't consider any other options.
What was she dying of?
Cancer.
You say you didn't know how difficult it was going to be. What surprised you the most?
The sheer physical exertion it took. I mean, I think it's staggering. In many cases, dying people don't sleep. They don't sleep. They sleep in tiny, tiny naps. They're afraid to sleep because they're afraid they won't wake up again, so they don't want to sleep. Also, in many cases, which was the case in my family, the dying person can have brain metastases, which means that their cognitive functions are impaired. They say crazy things and they maybe behave in a crazy way. Also, that can be an after effect of the medication, so that they can be very irascible. So that you're continually, it's very difficult to sleep. It's almost impossible to get good help to come in and work at night. That's the most difficult time to get staffing. In addition, one of the ways, of course, that people stay alive is through eating and drinking, and that becomes more and more difficult, so that you can sit by a person's bed with a tiny baby spoon with just a drop of food on it and try to get them to eat, or try to get a little bit of liquid into their mouth so that they can live. And the dying person may really want to live. And in my case, my mother was, when she was coherent, was determined to live and wanted that, but nothing tasted good because she had so many lesions in her mouth from the chemotherapy, so that we were continually trying to find something that she could eat, something that she could drink. And it was extremely frustrating, but it would take literally hours to get maybe a little Dixie cup of food into her.
When your mother was disoriented, were there periods that she wouldn't even recognize you?
No, she always recognized us, but she would be very angry sometimes, and then later on she would apologize. And that was very upsetting, given how much energy my family and I were putting into taking care of her. And then she would lash out at us. And that definitely is one of the aspects about taking care of a dying person, is that the social niceties tend to disappear. I mean, people are very honest. And if you can't tolerate that intense emotional intimacy and sort of raw emotions, it's probably not a good idea to be a part of this. So that whatever feelings she was having were very present, and we had to deal with that, and sometimes that wasn't so easy to deal with.
Well, what you really want in a situation like this is someone who is endlessly appreciative of the sacrifice that you're making by caring for them, not their anger.
Right, but you often get their anger, and you get the other stuff too. I mean, but there's something, there's something very refreshing about the complete honesty of it. I mean, you're at such a bare bones kind of survival, frontier almost in your life, that there's something extremely powerful about that honesty. I mean, you feel like you're in a completely different state, and you are.
Did you find yourself talking about things with your mother that you had never talked with her before?
Well, no. I mean, she was having enough trouble dealing with her death herself, and she was cognitively disoriented enough. I mean, there were periods when she would be immensely clear. But there were other periods when, we just couldn't talk to her. And I'm sorry. I mean, I'm sorry that didn't happen. I know other people did have that experience, people I interviewed, and were really able to have very deep, probing discussions and clear up a whole lot of aspects of their past. And that was quite wonderful, but we didn't do that.
Did she want to die at home?
Oh, die at home? She didn't want to die at all. I mean, she wasn't really willing to accept that. She very much wanted to be home, and she was extremely grateful when she got home. And that, the relief and the pleasure in her voice when, she finally arrived at our house was really worth a lot, because she'd been in the hospital for a long time.
What were some of the difficult medical decisions you had to face when she was home?
That's one of the aspects of this whole process that is extremely important, and somehow it's difficult to talk about. You, as the caregiver, you're the person on the front line, and when somebody is that fragile, you can make the decision that could, in fact, end their life. I mean, they're so delicate. You don't know from one day to the next whether the medication you gave them, the day before is the right medication to give them, that dose is the right medication to give them now. And you could potentially do something that could end their life. And now you have support. You have nurses that you can call all the time or who can come out, but they can't be there every minute. So I found myself continually making decisions that were far beyond what I considered my competence. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot very fast. But it was an incredible responsibility, and that was frightening.
Give me an example of the kind of decision you're talking about.
For instance, she would be very agitated, and she wasn't in any pain. So we would argue. One of my sisters would argue for the fact that she should have some medication that would reduce the medication. That if she'd been in pain, the narcotic effect would have reduced the medication. I mean, the agitation. So we would try different kinds of drugs to see what would potentially reduce her agitation. But the difficulty with trying, we tried different sleeping pills or different tranquilizers and things like that. But the difficulty would be that we could give her something that was so strong that her body couldn't tolerate it, and potentially could reduce her ability to breathe. Or another problem would be that because of these lesions in her mouth, some of the medications we tried could cause her excruciating pain. So there was this trade-off between, on the one hand, trying to reduce her agitation so that she would be more at peace with herself, and on the other hand, worrying about the side effects that some of these medications that we gave could create. We had a very frightening thing happen soon after we brought her home to the from the hospital, in which we reduced one medication inappropriately because of some bad advice we had, and she almost died from that. And so, we were very conscious of just how delicate the balance was.
Were you with your mother when she died?
She waited. My sister and I were taking turns checking on her every 15 minutes because she'd become dramatically worse. And she waited until I had left the room and died between the time that one of us, we were out of the room. We weren't there that exact moment.
Neither of you were there?
No.
You think she wanted it that way?
Yes, I believe she did. And in fact, in almost all the cases that I interviewed, people described similar things. Either the dying person waited until everybody was there or waited until nobody was there. They seem to be, and a lot of research seems to show that the dying person exercises some level of control over that moment.
Can I ask how you felt about her waiting until you left?
You know, the whole process, I mean, the very end of her death was so traumatic for me that I didn't particularly react to that moment. The whole last period was pretty, I think she suffered a lot in the end. And I didn't, that particular factor that she had, you know, when somebody dies, when they're that sick, it's hard to say exactly when they've died, in a sense. I know that sounds awkward, but there was a point at which her respiration stopped, but there was a process in which there was less and less of her there, and more of her had passed on to a point where she wasn't there. And it really was more of a transition than a final point. I mean, I felt a day and a half before she died, she became suddenly much more clear and, you know, alert than she'd been in weeks. And we had a wonderful talk, and we sort of all had this great talk with her, and she was like completely like herself. And I felt that was the period in which she sort of said goodbye to us. And then from then on, it was really like this transition where there was less and less of her present. And so at that exact moment didn't mean that much to me.
Do you think that it affected the mourning process for you to have been with her during the last weeks of her life?
Well, I think it affected it in two ways. One, I think I had thought I would be less grief-stricken when she died than I was because I'd been so close to the death process. And many people, you know, many people said that too, that caregivers were startled that they were so grief-stricken because they thought they were sort of dealing with their grief by being part of the caregiving, and none of us were. You know, it was very dramatic for all of us. So in that sense, it didn't help. But in the sense that it did help was that I had so many supporters, so many friends and colleagues and family members around me during this process of caregiving, that process of feeling very, very taken care of by my friends and community really helped me later in adapting to my grief.
What room did you give your mother when you brought her home?
We were fortunate. We had a study in our house, which had, you know, very large windows in it, and so we were able to put her in that room so that she had a lovely view to the outside.
How long did it take you after her death until you felt like you could use it as a study again?
Oh, maybe a few weeks. It wasn't that hard. I mean, for some people, one or two people I interviewed, it was more difficult, but it wasn't that hard for me.
Would you say that your experiences taking care of your mother brought you closer to the rest of the family, or were the difficulties such that they brought out differences and conflicts?
Well, in my family, it definitely brought us closer. I mean, I think, you know, it can go either way. It can, you know, if there's a desire to work out conflict, a situation like this can really, you know, it puts things right on the line, and it can bring a family much closer together. On the other hand, if those conflicts can't be resolved, there are many cases in my research where family members haven't spoken to each other since the death.
Hmm. Well, Andrea Sankar, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Nandra Sankar is a medical anthropologist and author of the new book, Dying at Home, A Family Guide for Caregiving, and she heads the medical anthropology program in the Department of Anthropology at Wayne State University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Last week, parliamentary elections were held in Czechoslovakia, bringing Slovak nationalists to power and bringing the country closer to dissolution. Coming up, we talk about the deepening divide between Slovaks and Czechs with journalist Lawrence Weschler. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Mary McCarthy's last book, Intellectual Memoirs, about New York intellectual life in the late 1930s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has arrived in Washington for his meetings tomorrow with President Bush. Mr. Bush said today that he wants an arms control agreement with Russia, making deep cuts in nuclear weapons. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The U.S. wants Russia to scrap all of its remaining land-based missiles with multiple warheads. Russia says the U.S. is seeking nuclear superiority. In an interview on CNN today, President Bush said he plans to reassure Yeltsin that's not the case.
My pitch to him will be, look, we're trying to help you. We're not your enemy. We're your friend. And so let's do what it is, leave out whether it's parity or disparity, to demonstrate to each other that we both understand this and demonstrate to the world that we want lower levels of nuclear weapons.
President Bush also pleaded with Congress to approve an aid package for Russia, saying the U.S. has spent trillions of dollars on confrontation and now has a chance to guarantee democracy and freedom. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Secretary of State James Baker says some very difficult problems still have to be worked out before a new missile-cutting agreement with Russia can be announced. Russian President Boris Yeltsin and President Bush meet tomorrow at the White House, and while Baker says that he would like to say agreement is at hand on a new treaty, he cannot say that now. Baker says that both leaders are committed to another round of weapons cuts, but he did not say what problems are not solved. Vice President Dan Quayle went to New York today and continued his attacks on the liberal establishment. His main target was New York, a city he described as dying from liberalism's failures. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
The vice president spoke at a luncheon sponsored by the Manhattan Institute, a conservative think tank. The audience included conservative business executives and foundation representatives who applauded his remarks, and seemingly almost everyone in the New York media, they listened politely. The vice president insisted that he supported the hardworking people of New York and was only bashing the city's entrenched liberal policies. Still, he said Democrats chose New York City for their convention out of a compulsion to return to the scene of the crime. Most Americans, he said, will watch the convention feeling.
We must not let them do to the rest of America what they have done to the people of New York City.
And he described New York's Governor Mario Cuomo as liberalism's sensitive philosopher king. The vice president's speech emphasized choice in education, a reduced tax burden on businesses, and an end to rent control. I'm Margot Adler in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up less than 1 point to close at 3,354.90. on volume of some 159 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 9-7. This is NPR News. According to Iran's official news agency, two Germans held hostage in Lebanon have been turned over to security officials in Beirut. Earlier today, the group claiming to have kidnapped the two relief workers said that they would be set free within 48 hours. According to a Lebanese security source, the Germans were moved to a basement in southern Beirut last week. They had reportedly been held separately prior to that. The two men had been working at Palestinian refugee camps when they were kidnapped more than 3 years ago. The Japanese parliament today passed a bill to allow Japanese troops in peacekeeping operations overseas for the first time since World War II. NPR's Marjorie Sun reports from Tokyo.
The legislation has divided the parliament and the country for the past 2 years. Opponents say the bill could lead to a resurgence of Japanese militarism. The legislation, however, only allows troops to participate in UN peacekeeping activities and only in non-combat operations, such as providing medical aid. The main opposition party tried to kill the bill during the past 2 weeks. It used a delaying tactic called the ox walk, in which members walked slowly to a ballot box in the parliament chamber to cast votes. Today, opposition members made a last-ditch effort to try to block the bill by resigning en masse in the lower house. But since the ruling Liberal Democratic Party holds a majority there, the bill passed easily. I'm Marjorie Sun in Tokyo.
In Bosnia, fighting has once again marred a ceasefire. There's heavy fighting reported in the western part of the state and some violence reported in the capital. Meanwhile, the Yugoslav parliament has chosen a Serbian hardliner as leader of a new and smaller nation. Western leaders have accused Serbia of encouraging ethnic fighting that has killed at least 15,000 people over the last year. More than a dozen ceasefires have failed. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Communism came to a peaceful end in Czechoslovakia during that country's Velvet Revolution. One of the country's leading dissidents and intellectuals, Václav Havel, became the president. But the Havel era seems to be ending, and Czechoslovakia may be on the verge of splitting in two. Havel's party did poorly in recent parliamentary elections. The winners were Slovak nationalists and Czech capitalists. But they have differences which may prove irreconcilable. To help explain what's happening in Czechoslovakia, we called Lawrence Weschler, a staff writer for The New Yorker, who is now writing an article based on his recent trip to Czechoslovakia. He's been reporting on Eastern Europe since the early days of Poland's solidarity movement. Some say that Havel is the only person who can hold Czechoslovakia together, but it doesn't look like he'll remain president much longer.
Interestingly, Havel remains the most popular person in the country, and if people were allowed to vote in a popular election for the president, undoubtedly Havel would win. But it is a parliamentary system, and the parliament, the way it's structured, elects the president, and the country is in the process of breaking up in various ways, including the nationalist problem that we were talking about before. There is a definite distinction between how people feel in Slovakia and how people feel in the Czech lands. And in a way, there has to be unanimity almost for Havel to remain president, and there's not going to be that, it looks like.
Well, let's look at who the leaders are now in Czechoslovakia after the parliamentary elections. We have Václav Klaus, who's the leader of the largest Czech party. Who is he?
Klaus is a very interesting case. He is a what I call a utopian capitalist. He is a Thatcherite, virtually. I mean, in fact, he was running ads by Thatcher in his campaign. He wants to convert to capitalism absolutely as quickly as possible. His plans make the shock therapy that Poland went through look relatively benign. Now, his background is that he in no way participated in the Charter 77 movement or the oppositionist movement in the old days. He was one of the people, one of the millions and millions of people in Czechoslovakia who were perfectly happy to live their lives, not confronting the regime, not being heroes. There are stories about as late as 1989, Klaus, who was at that time working in the Economic Forecasting Institute. He was not a Communist Party member, but he had the protection of the head of the institute, who was a communist, and he was asked at a key moment whether he would sign a protest in 1989 against Havel being imprisoned as late as that, and he refused to do it. He is the quintessential kind of technocratic member of what's called in Czechoslovakia the gray zone, people who didn't actively support the regime but in no way opposed it. And now that it's in a way now at a point where it doesn't really take any courage to oppose the regime, he turns out to be this incredibly fierce anti-communist, and a large part of his campaign is being more anti-communist than thou, and specifically more anti-communist than people like Havel and so forth, who he ridicules for being too weak and if anything tainted by their socialist or socialism with a human face, all those old kinds of associations. Klaus personally doesn't attack Havel that way, personally, but his party attacked all of Havel's associates in exactly that way, and it was very effective.
We have Vladimir Meciar, who is the head of the Slovak's most popular party. He probably wants to secede from Czechoslovakia, to break away. Why does he want to do that?
Well, it's not entirely clear that he wants to secede, but he definitely wants more autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
He is, in a way, the exact opposite of Klaus, and the nightmare in Czechoslovakia is that the two separate parts of the country, the Czech part and the Slovak part, have gone entirely opposite ways in the election. Mečiar was an old-line communist. He reminds me, to some extent, of Milosevic in Serbia. He is one of these old-line communists who has reinvented himself as a fierce nationalist, and his authority comes from his nationalism. He was a rather horrendous, horrible, old-style communist. It appears that he was probably deeply steeped in the secret police. He may have been an informer, and in any case, he used secret police files in rather disgusting ways. But he wraps himself up in Slovakian nationalism, and when he gets attacked for being a communist or a socialist, he says, forget that, I'm a Slovak, and it works. Now, having said that, it is also the case that the sorts of cures that Klaus wants to try in the Czech lands, these very fierce capitalist transformation cures, which may in fact work to some extent in the Czech lands, will probably not work at all in the Slovak areas. And so that Mečiar is defending the Slovakian region from this incursion of this kind of mad dog utopian capitalist onslaught. Having said that, the way he's doing it is by really entrenching the old communists in rather horrible ways. And so Slovakia, people in Slovakia have a terrible choice at this point. They can either stick out with Mečiar, who is going to kind of put them in the worst of their old culture, or they can go with Klaus, whose economic programs doesn't have much to offer them.
Why wouldn't Klaus's form of capitalism work in the Slovak lands?
Slovakia, going back a ways, the Slavs came into Europe from Asia, from Russia, that area, and the deepest penetration of Europe was in the Czech lands. There's a finger that goes all the way to Prague, virtually, into Germany. The part that was the most extended of that finger and that was entirely surrounded by German-speaking languages were the Czechs. Closer into the hand, let's say, were the Slovaks. They were not surrounded by the Germans. The ones that were completely surrounded by German speakers were part, eventually, of the Austrian side of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And they were allowed to become, the Czechs tended to be more secularist, more Western-looking. They had tremendous capitalist development in the Czech lands around Prague, for example. I was amazed to find out that half of the steel production in Europe in the 1930s took place in the areas around Prague and the Czech lands. So they had tremendous development. Slovakia, on the other hand, was part of the Hungarian Empire. It was part of there's the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The Austrian side was much more tolerant of its Slavs. The Hungarian side was much more repressive, punitive, did not develop that area. The Slovakian side was primarily agricultural, had no independent industrial production, really. And when the communists after 1918, they were constituted as a single country after the Austro-Hungarian Empire had broken down. The Czech side and the Slovak side were put together. Czechs and Slovaks are both Slavs. They speak different languages, but they are mutually intelligible to each other. But they have had these different upbringings in the Austrian side and the Hungarian side. And all through the 1920s and 30s, there was a whole problem about how to develop Slovakia as opposed to how to develop the Czech lands. Well, when the communists come into power after 1948, they notice that the Slovak lands are much more agricultural, and this is not part of communist doctrine. So they go on its crash drive to industrialize them. And there's a tremendous amount of industrialization that takes place in Slovakia, of the communist style, which are these huge behemoth dinosaur industries. On the Czech side, you still have these kind of Western style industries, but on the Slovak side, it's these terrible old dinosaurs that get constructed. Also, for example, you have an awful lot of arms manufacture that takes place in the Slovak regions. They don't do it on the Czech side because the Czech side is much closer to the front of an eventual war. the Czech side, Prague is, you know, only 100 miles or so from the German border, 50 miles from the Austrian border, so they don't want to have arms manufacturing there. They put that all in the Slovak areas, which is closer to the Soviet Union, with the result that the working classes in Slovakia are all tied to these monstrous factories that if Klaus has his way, they're all going to get shut down. Already today, in the Czech areas, you only have 3% unemployment. In the Slovak areas, and they haven't even started the crash programs, there's already 12% unemployment. So when Klaus, who basically says there should be a minimum amount of state intervention in the economy, when he says that to the Slovaks say, well, wait a second, all these places will shut down. If there's no planning, if it's not done slowly, it's going to be a disaster. And so they're very scared. And who do they turn to? They turn to their old communist bosses who have recast themselves as these nationalists.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Lawrence Weschler, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He recently returned from Czechoslovakia. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lawrence Weschler, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He's working on an article on Czechoslovakia from where he recently returned. If Slovakia has all the old dinosaur industries and is the poorer half of Czechoslovakia, why would the Czechs want to prevent them from splitting off?
A while ago, the Czechs did not at all want to let the Slovaks leave. There's now some talk that, fine. Get lost. Go ahead. You guys are a drag to be around anyway, especially if you go choosing these ridiculous dinosaurs like Mečiar as your leader. Get lost. Now, the reasons, there are various reasons that it's a problem for Klaus, for example, if the breakup takes place. Klaus is interested in a lightning-swift transformation to capitalism, and he needs a tremendous amount of foreign investment very quickly. And if things were completely quiet, there's a good chance he would get a lot of it. I mean, there was Czechoslovakia was, as I said, a highly industrialized. The Czech lands were highly industrialized in the old days, and there are a lot of Western companies happy to go back into the Czech lands. But if Czechoslovakia is first of all deadlocked in its parliament and can't get things passed, it can't get bills to do the transformation because there's this whole Slovak contingent that refuses to vote for it. Then there just literally won't be the laws on the books, commercial codes and things like that will be filibustered continuously. So that's a blockage. Now, the thing that you might want to do at that point is get rid of the Slovaks, say, fine, make your own country. But that is tremendously complicated. The way the communist country system was set up, there were these, you know, the metal industry was spread throughout the country. And as you break it up, parts of it are in Slovakia, parts of it are in the Czech lands. Another problem is that one of the things that the Czechoslovakians like to advertise themselves or in Prague was that they were a wonderful finger for Western Europe going the other way, a finger going back into the Soviet Empire, that the Czech-Slovak railroad, in effect, went right into the Ukraine and beyond that into Russia. And so it was a wonderful trading center, and that's why IBM and Xerox and Mercedes-Benz and so forth should locate in the Czech lands, because it was directly attached to the Slovak lands and before you know it into Eastern Europe, into the East. But if there's a breakup, if there begins to be a militarized border, let's say, between the Czech lands and the Slovak lands, that advantage disappears. So there are various reasons why they would want to avoid the breakup, and they may still try to do that. But having said that, it's looking less and less likely these days.
The Charter 77 people in the parliamentary elections that just happened did not do well. How much of that would you attribute to them, to disenchantment with them as leaders, and how much would you attribute to the quality of their campaign?
Well, this is an interesting issue. Charter 77 broke up into these kind of right and left wings. The right wings portrayed themselves, tended to get near Klaus, although they tried to, parenthetically, they tried to distinguish themselves by Klaus by saying, we are Charter 77 Klausians as opposed to Klausians. Interestingly, in the final analysis, even those people lost out. Klaus got the votes, and the Charter 77 Klausians didn't get the vote, so many of them didn't make it into parliament either. But the other ones, the kind of socialism with a human face, Dean Speer, people who Havel generally was more sympathetic was with, people like Orban and so forth, they had this party called OH. And this party's political campaigning was absolutely pathetic. I mean, they were just hapless, and they didn't know how to deal with the lustration issue. They weren't militantly principled on it. They kind of waffled. Beyond that, it was unclear exactly what their critique of Klaus was. Were they for reform? Were they not for reform? Were they for Klausian reform? It was unclear. Eventually, I mean, in the early days of the campaign, from one day to the next, there are billboards all over the country. And the OH billboard, the initial billboard, was a body of water. I mean, it was like a photograph of water, like of a pool, but it was taken maybe 4 or 5 feet above the pool, and all you saw was water from one end of the billboard to the other. And on top of it was an exclamation point, and the slogan was, "Our way is the right way."
What does that mean?
He just looked at it. He said, "What does that mean? I mean, we're all going into the lake with you. We're going down the drain." I mean, I think it must have been trying to talk about purity or something. I'm not even sure what it was. Nobody could figure it out. As Klaus, meanwhile, had standard American, you know, Saatchi and Saatchi, Thatcherite ads. I mean, bold guys in suits marching forward, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And people who knew the people who were in the posters said, you know, that guy's completely nebby, but he's dressed up in a suit. He looks fantastic, you know. And so there was that kind of campaigning on Klaus's party. And meanwhile, these kind of sweet-natured idealists, which is the very thing that allowed them to fight the regime for 20 years, was their kind of crazy idealism. They presented themselves as kind of haplessly crazy and idealistic, and people said, "Well, look, we need hard-headed people who know how to negotiate and know how to..." And one of the things that also happened, by the way, in the election was that Klaus and Metsiar kind of invented each other, that the Czechs came to feel they needed a dynamic leader like Klaus to fight Metsiar, and Metsiar was able to present himself as the only man who could stand up to Klaus, Those two swamped the elections.
Lawrence Weschler, he's a staff writer for The New Yorker. His latest book, A Miracle, A Universe, Settling Accounts with Torturers, has been published in paperback. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. Today we have a piece from Howard Berkus, which is on wolves being reintroduced into isolated areas of Montana where people have gone to live because they like the wild country. But apparently they don't like wolves as much as they thought they liked the idea of wolves. We also have a Supreme Court decision that says that the United States can kidnap people we wish to put on trial in this country and bring them back to this country to try them. In other court action, there's a suit in Miami on the part of homeless people who are suing for the right to sleep in the parks.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. During Mary McCarthy's lifetime, it's safe to say that she vied with her bitter rival, Lillian Hellman, for the title of Premier American Woman of Letters. McCarthy wrote criticism, best-selling novels like The Company She Keeps and The Group, political commentary, and autobiography. When writing autobiography, McCarthy says she was guided by George Orwell's remark that an autobiography that does not tell something bad about an author cannot be any good. McCarthy's book, Intellectual Memoirs, was the last thing she wrote before she died in 1989, and commentator Maureen Corrigan says Orwell would be pleased.
Mary McCarthy's Intellectual Memoirs is one of those books that leave you convinced you were born in the wrong place at the wrong time. For McCarthy, New York during the late 1930s was like a giant chromium cocktail shaker, in which literature, leftist politics, and romance were all mixed together in a glorious slow gin fizz. McCarthy tells us about spending long afternoons with other intellectuals at the Central Park Zoo cafeteria, drinking beer, arguing, and watching the seals. At a Trotskyist party, McCarthy got pickled and sat in Max Eastman's lap. She also remembers strolling down to the New School to hear Gertrude Stein talk, and swimming in a stream near critic Dwight MacDonald's summer house. McCarthy and her lover Philip Rov, along with MacDonald and his wife Nancy, discussed the novels of Henry James as they paddled naked in the water. Ah, what a time it was. Nowadays, most New York intellectuals have been rounded up and quarantined in remote college campuses, where they get their Saturday night kicks by reading advance copies of the Sunday New York Times Book Review. Intellectual Memoirs is not as psychologically rich as McCarthy's most magnificent autobiographical work, Memories of a Catholic Girlhood, but it's a small, sharp portrait of an exciting time. McCarthy was just 24 years old in 1936, but she seems to have held her own intellectually and sexually with the mostly male company she kept. She began to make her mark by writing book reviews for The Nation. And after her first marriage fell apart, McCarthy tells us that she slept with so many men, she soon stopped counting. Eventually, she moved in with Philip Rov, an editor of the Partisan Review. McCarthy herself was made theater critic for the review because, she said, the boys didn't trust my critical skills in other fields. That's a rare admission for McCarthy. Mostly she prefers to ignore the whole issue of how being a woman may have sometimes hindered or helped her career. Certainly it was her beauty as well as her brilliance that endeared her to Edmund Wilson. McCarthy, however, initially pretends she can't fathom her own motives for marrying Wilson, the foremost American critic of the time. She says she never loved him and describes him as fat, pink, pop-eyed, and sweaty. McCarthy theorizes that maybe she gave in to Wilson because she wanted to punish herself for cheating on Philip Rov. Or maybe because both she and Wilson were WASPs who liked nature. Right. Finally, on the last pages of the memoir, she comes clean and admits that Wilson promised he would do something for her career. He did. Wilson encouraged McCarthy to write fiction. Without Wilson, she says, I would not be the Mary McCarthy you are now reading. Yet, awful to say, I am not particularly grateful. That's not a pretty statement, but fans of Mary McCarthy read her for the way she encourages us to pare away fictions and self-protective lies. McCarthy's own hard edge keeps me from overindulging in fantasies about a New York literary culture that's probably a lot more fun to read about than it was to live in.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Mary McCarthy's Intellectual Memoirs. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with associate producer Joan Tuohy and Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This week, the American Music Theater Festival premieres the new opera Tanya, based on the kidnapping of Patty Hearst. On the next Fresh Air, we meet the composer, Anthony Davis, who also wrote the opera X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X. The two leads from Tanya will be with us to perform. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.